All right, we have, bringing us up to speed, since I know some of us haven't been here, we started with prophecies of the church in the Old Testament. Then we looked at how they were fulfilled in the New Testament in the first century. Then we looked at some departures in the early church that the apostles said were going to take place. And we looked at places like Acts chapter 20 and others. And then we looked at those early departures in the first two or three centuries, especially ones dealing with leadership and people having authority over several congregations. And then we looked at the beginning of the Roman Catholic Church and the so-called Dark Ages and things that were going on during the Dark Ages. Then we went to kind of what's called the Protestant Reformation and people who were involved in starting that, like Martin Luther and Ulrich Zwingli and people like that, and why they did what they did, and especially how people wanted to get the Bible into people's hands, everybody's hands, so that they could read it. We spent time with John Calvin because of how influential his teachings and writings have been and still are. John Calvin's writings are mandatory in a lot of seminaries throughout the country. Then we started to look at others who were influential in trying to reform the Roman Catholic Church. And then last week I mentioned that today we were going to look at a few people from Scotland. These people, we owe a lot to them because they were some of the very first ones, at least in the modern era, I guess we should say, that started to see that Reformation wasn't sufficient. That we had to go all the way back to the Bible, all the way back to the first century, if we really wanted to have the church that Jesus built. And so some of these people I'm going to mention today, all of them were from Scotland, and they all, this was all back in the early 1800s. So we're talking about 200 years ago, a little over. These people from various parts started to teach and practice some of the things that we see today are absolutely essential. So that's why we owe a lot to them. They didn't go far enough in some instances, but they were some of the first ones in this era that really started to see how necessary it was. The first one I'm going to mention is a guy by the name of John Glass, G-L-A-S. He was one of the very first ones, because he even goes back to the 1700s, Scottish. He came from a Church of Scotland background, so he came from a Protestant background. When he became an adult, though, he started to see, and like I said, one of the very first ones, started to see that the Word of God by itself, nothing else, just this, needed to be everybody's sole standard of authority. In other words, nothing else, no traditions, no committees, no anything else. And if you couldn't show that the Bible taught it, in other words, if you couldn't show that the first century church, all right, that it was based upon what that first century church did, then it wasn't acceptable. That was a huge step. I mean, that was just an enormous step. He began seeing that there were major differences in the Church of Scotland and what the Bible taught. And so he started I guess we would say, preaching only what the Word of God taught. And that meant that he was preaching against some of the things that he grew up in. Because he grew up in the Church of Scotland. His dad was a minister in the Church of Scotland. So that took a lot of courage for him to do that. But he saw that if you were only going to preach the Bible and take the Bible as the sole Word of God, then these practices were wrong. They were totally wrong. So there was a whole list of things that he started to teach that went against the Church of Scotland. And he ended up leaving the Church of Scotland and starting an independent church. And this was, interestingly enough, almost the exact same time that the Declaration of Independence in the United States was being signed. So we're talking about the 1770s, give you a time frame. Some of the things, there was about 100 people that started this independent church. They agreed to follow Christ the Lord. They agreed to work together in brotherly love. They followed the practice of church discipline in Matthew 18. They formed themselves into a society of believers. They, in the Church of Scotland, they observed the Lord's Supper once a quarter. Well, they started observing it monthly. So they're getting closer. See, it's a journey. They're starting to see how wrong the Church of Scotland was in many, many areas. One of the things that he strongly taught was that the church and the kingdom were not of this world. They were not earthly. Well, you know, in Great Britain, you go back even to 1000 AD, people were thinking that the church was an earthly kingdom. And there was Christ was going to come back and reign on earth. And so that belief was an old belief. Of course, a lot of people believe it today too, unfortunately. But he saw, even back in the 1700s, that the kingdom was not on earth. Jesus wasn't going to come back and reign on earth. It was a spiritual kingdom. So the church was a spiritual one, not an earthly one. And of course, that got him in big trouble from a lot of people. Because many, if not most, so-called Christians believed in an earthly kingdom. But he saw the New Testament didn't teach that. And like I said, got him into trouble. He was brought before all kinds of committees and meetings and so forth. He was suspended as a minister. The very last years of his life, what he decided to do was he opened up a bookstore, a religious bookstore. And people would come there for, materials that he could sell, that he believed in. And one of the most important things that happened during that time was he met a man named Robert Sandeman, another Scottish guy. Sandeman became his son-in-law. And Sandeman took his father-in-law's ideas and got them even closer to the New Testament. Yes?
Probably covered it while I was down with the surgery. But why did the church, for example, Glassman's church, do monthly communion versus weekly? We see in the New Testament.
Right, right. Why did they do monthly? I have not read why they did it monthly. I haven't found that. Why they went from a quarterly to monthly. Maybe they thought going to weekly was too big a change. I don't know. I've never read why. That's a good question.
I don't think, because there are a couple of churches around still to this day that do a monthly communion.
Mm-hmm. Some do monthly, quarterly, right.
I don't understand the scriptural reason.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing in the New Testament, like you said, that even hints of monthly or quarterly. Yeah, that has to be entirely a human, of human origin. Yeah, because there's nothing in there that would suggest monthly or quarterly. Absolutely. But I've never read why he went from quarterly to monthly. Because we're going to read about some of the people that took it from monthly to weekly. Yes, I'm sorry. Right.
Which church I think that seems to mean.
Yeah.
The missionary Baptists take it to mean that they met for a meal.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. So a lot of Baptists they take communion that. Once a month or once every 6 months, or if there's no rhyme or reason.
That doesn't make any difference. Okay, gotcha. All right, good point. All right, well, Sandeman. He was also part of the Church of Scotland. He wrote some very important religious works that basically were a rebuttal of John Calvin. Remember, John Calvin had taught his tulip philosophy, the total depravity and limited atonement and one saved, always saved, perseverance of the saints. Well, Sandeman saw that all of that was unscriptural. So he wrote some volumes that were basically saying all of Calvinism is wrong. And he went to London and various places teaching this. He was also very influential in America. All right? And some of the churches that he started, people started calling them Sandemanian churches after him. And so those churches were started all over the Northeast, like in Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts and places like that when he came over here. But one of the big things he did was he denied Calvinism. So there's another big step. All right, because many, many churches, if not most Protestant churches, all believed in Calvinism. And so what, you know, some of the things he did was trying to get people away from Calvinism. So there was another big step. So we're seeing, like with Glass and then with Sandeman, we're seeing people get closer and closer to the New Testament in their teachings. Then we come to two brothers who also had enormous influence, and they were also from Scotland, Robert and James Haldane. And they learned from others, I guess I would say. They'd heard some independent church preachers who influenced them a great deal. They were fairly wealthy. I mean, you can go online and look at the place they grew up in. Kind of looks like a Scottish castle. They came from money. But they also, they started operating schools, which was fairly unusual at the time. They separated from the Church of England, along with Greville Ewing. All three of them did. And they started a church that was similar to the, you know, Glass and Sandeman. They were about the first ones that started observing the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. Okay? So, we're talking around 1800. So, the Haldanes and Greville Ewing saw that the Bible taught you should and must take it every Sunday. They also took up weekly collections every Sunday, just like 1 Corinthians 16 teaches. So, again, we're getting closer and closer and closer to what the New Testament teaches. They were getting away from Calvinism, about being saved by faith alone. Come on in, Barb. Good to see you. We were just talking about taking up collections. So if you want to leave some back there, that's fine. So now they're denying Calvinism. They're taking the Lord's Supper every Sunday. Collections every Sunday. And they called these, at the time, tabernacle churches. These are some of the things they were some of the first ones to teach the idea of restoring the New Testament church instead of reforming the Catholic Church. So the Haldanes and Ewings, another huge step in the right direction. They also believed that every congregation was autonomous. They weren't to be overseen by any other congregation. Everyone was self-governing. Each church had its own ministers and deacons and so forth. Like I mentioned, they observed the Lord's Supper every Sunday. Also, another big step, they taught that immersion was the only scriptural mode of baptism. So look at how in 100 years from 1700 to 1800, look at the enormous gains that happened in Scotland by people going solely back to the New Testament. The faith alone being wrong. Once saved, always saved, being wrong. They saw that you were to take the Lord's Supper every Sunday, collections every Sunday. Churches were autonomous, they were self-governing. The civil authorities had no authority over the church whatsoever. So by 1800, early 1800s, people are getting very close to restoring the New Testament church. And there were, like I said, great gains. And we should be thankful for these people because, you know, they were kicked out of the denominations that they were in, like the Church of Scotland, because they weren't towing the line, so to speak. But they were more concerned about what God said in His Word than what denominations taught. And that, especially at that time, we don't think about it so much nowadays, but at that time, that was a big, big deal. And as we see the emphasis change from Great Britain to the United States, we'll see how those people who were trying to restore the New Testament church in the United States, how they were persecuted. And they were persecuted a lot. And that persecution stayed, physical persecution, well into the 1900s. So these people had a lot of courage, and like I said, we should be very thankful for them. A lot of people in the denominational world believe that the Church of Christ traces their roots back to Thomas and Alexander Campbell. But what we're going to see is people were restoring the Church of Christ long before Thomas and Alexander Campbell were even born. So we don't have any affiliation in that sense with them. And we're going to see that there were people in all areas of the United States, east of the Mississippi River, that were starting pockets of restoring the church. In other words, going solely back to the Bible and only finding authority there. And we're going to see these people, like I said, popping up all over. I mean, there's going to be in New England, but there's going to be people in Ohio. There's going to be people in Tennessee. There's going to be people in Georgia. All over the eastern part of the United States that were trying to restore the Church of Christ. And I use that in a non-denominational sense. If you go back and read a lot of denominational writers from the 1800s especially, they all call the New Testament church the Church of Christ. So whether it was people like Clark or Barnes, people like that, they called the Church of Christ because that was its name. That's how it was designated. And even other writers call it the Church of Christ because it's a name to designate the original church. And so if you're trying to restore the original church, what better name to do that? So some of the early ones in New England, in the United States, were people like James O'Kelly, Elias Smith, Abner Jones, John Wright. And these were people in the late 1700s, early 1800s, who were pulling away from denominationalism. Now, Alexander Campbell was only 9 years old at this time. So these people were doing it long before Alexander Campbell had anything to do with it. The first one, Elias Smith, he broke away from the Baptist in New England. He made a great effort to try and establish the New Testament church. And one of the ways he did that was he started a journal, a religious newspaper called the Herald of Gospel Liberty. And then he later called it the Gospel Proclamation. And it's said to be the first gospel teaching paper in America. And that, again, was about 1800 or so. And in the paper, he taught people how to become Christians. In other words, that was its focus. But it was based upon how they became Christians in the New Testament. Not how they became so-called members of denominations, but how you became an actual Christian and how to stay faithful. Because it was important to stay faithful because you could lose your salvation. So this was huge. This was another huge step forward. Abner Jones is the last one we'll have any time to talk about. He was from Massachusetts. He also was in the Baptist church. He did like some of the others did. He began to study the scriptures and he saw that Calvin's teachings were an error. He saw that Calvin's teachings were an error. Well, obviously he came in conflict with the Baptist church because the Baptist church, almost all of them, follow John Calvin's teachings. So, I guess the best way to put it is he put forth a lot of effort to try and start simple New Testament churches. This would have been, again, around 1800 or so. And he started one in Vermont, and he rejected all human names and just said, we just need to be called Christians. We don't need to be called Baptists, Presbyterians, Methodists, just Christians. And then him and Elias Smith kind of start working together in those areas in New England. Well, that's probably a good place to stop. We're going to start seeing more people. James O'Kelly, the next one. And how they are also getting closer and closer and closer to what the New Testament teaches. And it's a wonderful story. And it's a story we should be very thankful for. What these men gave up to simply go back to the Bible.